Coming up today, AFA's IT systems analyst Britt Baskett will tell you how to avoid being scammed as you wrap up your Christmas shopping.
It could be just an opportunity for cyber criminals to be able to keep and capture like your credentials, like your password, your username, to be able to get into your account and take over.
Then MD Perkins will tell us why some people are claiming that words themselves equal violence.
When they say that words are violence, is the idea that you're attacking someone's autonomy or sense of personhood or even their right to define reality itself. And in doing that, it's tantamount to physical violence being enacted against that person.
It's the weekend of December 13th and 14th. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. And welcome to the program today. Well, with only 10 more days or so of Christmas shopping left, many are no doubt frantic about getting that last online order placed. But there are some dangers that you need to be aware of when it comes to online security. And joining me to talk about that is my colleague, Britt Baskett. Britt spent 13 years in the U.S. Army as an IT administrator. He has a master's in cybersecurity and is now IT systems analyst here at the American Family Association. Britt, great to have you on the program today.
Happy to be on.
So you've said that artificial intelligence is becoming the new Grinch of Christmas shopping. How exactly are criminals using AI to mimic companies like Amazon, and how is that a threat?
It is a threat because it's something that you and me, we use these companies every day. We use them for purchasing items, using it for tracking our packages, receiving notifications, receiving emails. So there's so many things that we are tied into with these companies. Therefore, these systems can be hacked or emails can be generated where someone could act as if they're Amazon to send you an email, to act as if they're them. They can send out an email, create a link for you to click, and then them have access to your account or your email account or even your bank account. So there's several things that are that we can be very vulnerable to whenever someone is trying to scam you.
You know, there have always been, I guess, scammers, whether it's online, telephone scammers. I mean, you know, you get those almost daily. How is artificial intelligence making this threat different? What is it about AI that separates this from other threats that we've seen in the past?
So with AI, it is making the average criminal smarter, more crafty, makes it easier for them to sound more professional. And it makes it so they're more successful with how to reach certain crowds. They can craft an email towards a specific community, like the retired community, or like a younger community, or working class, to carve that email into something specific to reach a specific group. Mm-hmm. Like we typically receive an email, hey, if I receive something about Medicare as far as like retirement and I'm not retirement age, then I would throw that email away. I won't care about it.
Okay.
But if they craft it to my age group or my department that I work in, it would make it more tempting for me to click on that link or to go down that rabbit hole of that phishing scam scam.
Okay. What do we need to know about AI-generated emails and fake shopping alerts when they can look so convincing?
So what you need to know is there's a couple of things that you need to check before verifying and clicking anything. Is first, go to the real website. So just go to google.com or type in whatever your bank is.com. Verify that that is the right website, the retail website. Go to that first. Log into your account. Verify that it is a notification that is truly going to your account. If it is something serious, it will show up in your real account. Never go through emails because links can be malicious, and it could be just an opportunity for cyber criminals to be able to keep and capture like your credentials, like your password, your username, to be able to get into your account and take over.
So when you look at an email in the from section, you're going to look for a domain that's the same as your bank or your store or whatever, and then verify that with the actual website to make sure they match.
Correct.
Yeah.
because easily you can see in several emails or texts, you'll see several different weird letters and numbers at suchandsuch.com. Opening those up, those are just red flags. Those are just little indicators. But those are just easy steps. But, of course, AI is making it easier for criminals to make it look closer to the real thing.
Yeah.
And even websites out there that is, like, for example, Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Someone could put two A's in Amazon, so Amazon.com, and then try to mirror Amazon, and people purchase from the fake website instead of the actual website itself. So,
okay. Britt, we're also hearing about voice cloning scams where a phone call can sound exactly like a child or a grandchild. This is really scary. What should families know about these kinds of deep fake scams, and what steps can they take to protect family members from some of these?
So, yes, it is very terrifying. I hear about calls all the time, such as calls like law enforcement calling someone saying, hey, your child is intoxicated. And we need you to speak to the lawyer here and provide a certain payment to release this individual.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so, and also to pull like any type of information out of someone. So it's called social engineering, where they use it to psychologically try to take your money or your information. So those are the two big things they aim for. But the fear is a factor. So fear is a factor. Shortage is a factor. If there isn't enough of something, it makes people want to move a lot faster. So it's really big on the psychology side of things. So if they're wanting you to move fast on something, it's a good chance it's a scam, because they want you to do something before you have time to think about
Immediate decisions or something to watch out for.
Yes, sir.
What about shortage? You mentioned shortage. What sort of a scam would be related to some sort of shortage that someone would have?
So if you remember back during COVID, there is the reports of shortages in toilet paper things like that. So say if there's a shortage in steaks at a particular store, more people are going to want to more likely try to click on that to see, hey, how can I get this before it's all gone?
I see. Okay.
So it creates a panic. Any way for the scammers to create some type of panic to make you want to click, that can psychologically make you want to click it more to make you do what they want you to do as far as trying to get your credentials.
So don't try to argue with these people. Just hang up.
Yes. So, because they're very malicious. If they're trying to ask for your information and they called you, there's a good chance that it could be a scam. If it's too good to be true, most of the time it is. But of course, the Lord has done miracles in my life and in other people's life, and He does perform miracles. But there are people who have ill intentions for us, referencing back to Proverbs 4:23. Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. So there are malicious people out there that isn't there for your sake. There are people there that do want to harm you and destroy you, like Satan.
Well, this is a very broad topic, and there's so many different ways people can be scammed. So bring it down to the conclusion for us. What are some final takeaways that people need to know in these final, you know, shopping days before Christmas to just watch out for being scammed?
So first of all, like, pause before you click, wait, and actually take time to look at the email. If it's something very important, like a bank account or anything like that, just go directly to the source. So don't even click the link, just go to the source. If it's from something special or important from someone, just go to the source. Say, call, hey, I appreciate you sending me that gift card gift. Did you mean to send that to me? And just verify that's real. And then second thing is verifying that it is truly your family that's calling, or law enforcement that's calling. So if family is in trouble and they call you, I would if it's urgent, hang up, call them right back just to verify it's the right source, because someone can spoof a phone number and act like they're your family member. Last, if it's too good to be true, most likely it is fake. So it's not worth getting that great deal or getting that brand new car that they say it's $5,000 for, like a Ford Raptor or something unimaginable like that. Most likely it is a scam. So if it's too good to be true, it's a fake.
All right. Well, very good. We'll put some links to some resources on our podcast page of that will enable you to find out more about what we've been talking about today. Scary world, but we don't need to live in fear, and there are practical things that we can do to safeguard our families against these. Britt Baskett, IT systems analyst here at American Family Association, thanks for joining us, and Merry Christmas to you.
Happy to be on.
A recent poll showed that over 90% of college students think that words can be equated with violence, leading some undergraduates to self-censor their own views on college campuses. The poll examined students' responses after the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Well, when did this new attitude that words could be equal to violence come about? And if that's true, where are we headed as a country? My guest is author and research fellow of church and culture here at AFA, M.D. Perkins. He's written an insightful article in this month's issue of The Stand magazine called When Did Words Become Violence? Free Speech, Double Standards, and the Assassination of Charlie Kirk. Hello, M.D.
Hey, Jeff. Good to be with you again.
This poll was conducted by the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. FIRE is the acronym. It was reported in the Christian Post. They showed that only 9% of the students in that poll completely disagreed with the idea that words can be violence. Only 9% disagreed with that. What do these people mean when they say that words can be violent?
Yeah, there's an important distinction we should probably make at the front end, where we've normally thought of violent rhetoric as being things like threats, open calls for violence against people, or even certain forms of name-calling or direct insults, things that would be inciting violence in other people. Or legally, when you think of things like slander or defamation, things that would, you know, harm someone's reputation, that's not what is being discussed here. The idea of words as violence is so much bigger and more expansive than that, because it's really getting at not just words, but inferences, jokes, a way of speaking, but even bigger, that the expression of certain ideas should be curtailed or could be seen as violent, like the equivalent of taking out a violent action against somebody. So what we're talking about here, or I guess what people are posing, is when they say that words are violence, is the idea that you're attacking someone's autonomy or sense of personhood or even their right to define reality itself. And in doing that, basically it's tantamount to physical violence being enacted against that person. Mm. So in the article, I said speech that wounds a person's feelings is being seen increasingly as the equivalent of actions that harm a person's body. And that's this idea. And I think you can see how dangerous that concept really is.
Yeah, that's extreme. Give me an example of some rhetoric that could be construed as violent.
Well, really, any conservative viewpoint is often being presented as a violent opinion. I mean, the idea that homosexuality is sinful, for example, is being held up as somehow violent because you're countering someone's sense of personhood and self-identity to be able to live however they want to live. So when I say that homosexuality is wrong, then they could be saying, well, you are actually inciting violence against someone who identifies as a homosexual because you're saying that that what they're doing is somehow is wrong. And of course, that's not what I'm doing with my words, but what they're getting at is that the idea is so offensive to them that it's tantamount to basically assaulting someone.
Yeah. How much of this is a ploy to justify a reaction against someone's public speech?
Well, I think that's really getting at the root of it.
Okay.
I think there is a major agenda, we could say, of trying to curtail particularly conservative Christian speech on these issues, to silence Christians, to make people feel like they shouldn't speak up or speak out about certain things, that it's not acceptable to have a certain viewpoint. So there's a sociological concept called the spiral of silence, which basically is this idea that when people hear their own viewpoints expressed publicly, that they feel invigorated by that and they feel like other people hold those views.
Okay.
But when those views are not expressed publicly, they feel more marginalized and feel like those views are actually not reflective of the larger culture at all. And so you can see how this impacts Christians especially.
Yeah.
When we don't hear our viewpoints expressed in media, on the airwaves or on television or in all these different social media platforms, it can give the impression that we're just weird, or we just have these kind of oddball ideas. Maybe it's just me. You know, this is something that AFA encounters a lot when people say, I thought I was the only person who thought this way, or I thought I was the only person who understood that's what the Bible's saying about this. And then when I heard you express this viewpoint on the radio or in the magazine or whatever, you know, I felt like someone else understands. And that's the idea that Christians, you know, sometimes we have to break that spiral of silence by just speaking out, even sometimes when it's uncomfortable or we feel like we might be the only ones saying that.
Yeah.
But in reality, we're probably not.
Yeah, that's a very important distinction to make, and something that we wouldn't think about, because we don't want to hurt people's feelings. I mean, especially believers, we're told to love and to show compassion and mercy. We don't want to do that, but we can err by really not speaking out when we should. And like you said, people can be encouraged by that. And these attitudes, MD, is there a particular age group of people that you see this attitude more than others?
Well, according to the surveys that were done, Gen Z would be the group, the age group, that would most be understood as agreeing with the statement that words are violence. And I'm not trying to pick on anybody. I'm just saying, according to the study, that was the age group that came forward. And you would expect for it to be the younger generation, right? Because they're growing up surrounded by text and imagery-based media. And so they live in a world of words and imagery where words actually become imagery as well, too.
Yeah.
And the need for more and more excessive and bold statements to really make your point. You know, the rise of cussing, for example, is kind of showing to me, at least as a researcher, that as a society, we've kind of lost the ability to speak clearly. And so we need to punctuate that speech with really harsh language that grabs people's attention. And so I think all of that is in the mix, why a younger generation would be more susceptible to this concept.
And you think of a generation that's raised on the screens and social media, those algorithms are designed to affirm you constantly.
Yeah.
And so what you have is a worldview or a media experience that is emphasizing everything that you already believe. So when you do encounter bold speech, it's new, something different.
Yeah, and there's kind of a need to take on labels for yourself, you know, self-identity labels, but also to put labels on those whom you disagree with. And we're hearing even stronger and stronger labels. I mean, how often have you heard that Donald Trump is a Nazi or a fascist? Or even in the death of Charlie Kirk, you know, he was labeled as a white nationalist. I was at a conference recently, the Pray Vote Stand event out in Chino Hills, California, and there were protesters out front of this event. And I was surprised to learn when I started to dig into why are people protesting this event? What was labeled as a white nationalist rally? Well, I would protest a white nationalist rally as
you
well.
You had no idea you were attending one of those.
I had no idea I was attending one. Neither did anyone else there.
Yeah.
Also, interestingly, the whole praise band that was doing the praise and worship music were comprised of people of different ethnic backgrounds and things.
Sure.
So it certainly wasn't a white nationalist rally.
Yeah.
But see, people need that kind of language because it makes someone else's ideas sound indefensible. And so it makes it easier to attack and to take down. And when you start to think about this culture of embracing the concept of words as violence,
mm-hmm.
you're actually in some ways inciting violence mm-hmm. through taking on and giving out these kinds of labels.
Perfect segue to my next question, because you reference in that article what you call the assassination culture.
Mm-hmm.
How mainstream is that becoming, MD?
Well, sadly, I mean, I think we all found in the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk assassination that it was way more mainstream than we wanted to think that it was, with the number of people online and even within our own timeline feeds on social media either justifying the death in some way, celebrating his death in some way,
yeah.
saying things that might in some ways kind of justify it or make it seem plausible or understandable. There was an associate professor at the University of Michigan who said that even if you believe violence isn't the answer, it is a solution. And so, wow. I mean, you have people like this who are saying things. Some of them are being disciplined by their institutions or being fired or whatever. But, I mean, that's a pretty major statement for an associate professor at a major college to put forward. You know, the Network Contagion Research Institute, which is run by Rutgers University, did a survey of this in December of 2024, so after the assassination attempts on Donald Trump had already taken place. And what they found is that those who identified as politically left of center were 55% of them said that the murder of Donald Trump would be somewhat justified. And even, you know, a smaller percentage saying it would be fully justified. I think that was like 14%. But I mean, over half of the people in this survey who identified as left of center said that it would be justified. And others would say that the death of Elon Musk or the murder of Elon Musk would be justified. 40% saying that property destruction of Tesla would be acceptable. And you think of the praise for like the Luis Mangione, the suspect in the United Healthcare case. You know, there was even in 2024, there was a ballot measure put forth in California that was described. It had this label of the Luigi Mangione Access to Healthcare Act. Like they were putting the name of a suspected killer in this bill to try and, you know, raise the cloud on it. I mean, that is a troubling trend. So in some ways, it may not seem mainstream. In other ways, some of this may be heightened just by different news stories and stuff that we hear. But it seems to be far more prevalent than I would have suspected.
I tell you what, MD, after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and I heard some of these things that were stated, I thought, man, what is going on? It's like someone flipped a switch. And all of a sudden, the gloves are off. And things that people would normally keep in their head are coming, not only coming out of their mouth, they're coming out in the classroom, in social media posts, in business posts. But thankfully, there was a clampdown after that people suffered consequences. They lost their jobs, I think rightfully so. Let me get your response to this, because in researching for this interview today, I looked cursory view of scripture, of things speaking to the boldness of speech. Ephesians 6:20 came up, and Paul is in prison. He's writing to the people in Ephesus, and he's speaking of the gospel. He says, "For which I am an ambassador in chains." Then he says, "Pray that I may proclaim it fearlessly, as I should." Yeah. That's always struck me, because the Apostle Paul is praying for boldness.
Yeah.
You know, the last person you would think would need to pray for boldness, he's asking for prayers. So, obviously, there's a spiritual component to speaking out, and even some of the things Charlie Kirk said were gospel-related.
Yes.
Not everything, but I think a lot of them were gospel-related. The sanctity of marriage, for example, mm-hmm. the sanctity of life. How should Christians respond to this when we consider who we are in this world?
Well, I think what you just said is excellent. I mean, consider the Apostle Paul. I mean, we're always tempted to be silent because we are so fearful and timid. I mean, there's a tendency there in us to just recede into the background, to not really stir up the waters mm-hmm. any, so to speak, and to just let our views kind of be quietly understood or assumed, but not really expressed. And that really isn't what God would have for us to do. But at the same time, as we want to speak boldly and fearlessly, we also want to remember Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, that is giving an admonition to the church to walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of the time. Yeah. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. And so, you know, if we hold both of those equally in our hands, not as an either or, but as something that we want to do, both of those things that the Bible commands us to do. We want to speak boldly and fearlessly, but we also want to do so with grace, seasoned with salt, understanding that we're trying to witness and represent Christ in this world, and we want to do that with integrity and with honesty.
Yeah, very, very good admonition, AMD. Thank you for that. One of the other cautions, I think, too, is that we can't assume, because these ideas are so radical, that all attempts to persuade can be fruitless, that there still is the ability to persuade people and to engage. I remember years ago, and particularly during the election cycle, we were praying for, you know, Lord, just leave the door open for the freedom to proclaim the gospel.
Yeah.
The idea being that if there is a free marketplace of ideas, all you need is a place to stand to speak. And so hopefully these ideas that words can be violence are not going to be something that's long-term.
Yeah, and we've seen the eradication or and the removal of some of those freedoms in Europe, for example, where many people are facing, you know, the swift hand of the government upon them whenever they even voice an opinion on social media. So it is an idea where if you don't exercise this right, you may in fact end up losing that right before you even realize that you gave it up.
Mm. Just circling back to where we were in the beginning, in the poll that we quoted at Utah Valley University following the Kirk assassination, at that time, 47% of the kids said that shouting down a speaker was never acceptable, 47%. But that number went up following the assassination to 54%. There seems to be room for people to change their thinking on this. Do you think that increased violence against speech will undermine itself in the minds of these people?
Yeah, that's an encouraging poll, I think, for us all to hear, because it does show that the situation isn't totally hopeless, that yeah. God has given us a witness in our heart that testifies when we see someone violently murdered, mm-hmm. we all should be shrinking back. And we've desensitized ourselves a lot with screens and all of these different things that want to distance and other different people and make us seem like we can't have any common ground or unity. But, you know, I have heard of cases of people who were very left-leaning or even leftists yeah. of fully sold out to that ideology that in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination began to rethink some of those ideas because of the violent rhetoric mm-hmm. that they were hearing among their peers on the left. And so I think that should be an encouragement that the Christian witness can still go forward even in the midst of times where it seems like where it seems really desperate yeah. and somewhat hopeless. It's never completely hopeless because we live in God's world and He's ultimately the one who is in charge of all of these things.
Perfect way to end the conversation. The article by my guest, M.D. Perkins, is titled, When Did Words Become Violence? Free Speech, Double Standards, and the Assassination of Charlie Kirk in this month's The Stand magazine. M.D., thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Jeff.
And coming up next week, Pastor Jeff Shreve will tell us how to recognize and defeat the lies and deceptions of the enemy. To find out how to get a free trial subscription to our Stand magazine and sign up for our daily email, visit afa.net/thestand. Thanks for being with us, and join us next time on The Stand Radio.